This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. In 2011, Willard Stern Randall wrote Ethan Allen, His Life and Times. He appeared on this program to discuss the book, and he talked about the importance of Ethan Allen in the creation of Vermont.
There would not have been a Vermont without Ethan Allen, basically. He was the first up here to see the potential after the French left, and he was the one that basically kept New Yorkers from just taking over and eliminating any possibility of an independent state. And he lines up with the same views of John Locke's philosophy that Vermont was this vacuum, this empty place in a state of nature, and you went in and you made a new order, a new kind of society. So I think he was very much philosophical and a sincere revolutionary, not just somebody to try to get land on the cheap.
Well, not so fast. That's a question that's in dispute. Was Ethan Allen a sincere revolutionary or a savvy real estate mogul? And what role did he play in Vermont's founding? Our guests today say the image of Ethan Allen as a clever and dashing military hero, a founder of Vermont, and an independent, brave frontiersman cut from rugged stock may not be entirely accurate. Ethan Allen has become a stand-in for Vermont values, but the man himself was a complicated figure who might not fit the iconic persona we hold him up to be. Nick Muller and John Duffy co-authored the new book, Inventing Ethan Allen, and they join us today. Welcome to the program. It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you for inviting us.
Thank you, Jane. Good to be here.
So, Nick Muller, I'd love for you to start. Just tick off some of the things that people today would be able to see that have Ethan Allen's name on them.
Would you like to go bowling?
Sure.
Would you like to ride the Amtrak train? Would you like to go to an antique store? Would you like to listen to what comes out of Kirby, Vermont, on an intellectual institute, the Ethan Allen Institute? Would you like to buy a carton of milk? Did you used to belong to an exclusive men's club in Burlington that's gone? All of those things have Ethan Allen's name, not to mention naval vessels, an attack submarine.
The fort we are in right this moment
chat. Yes.
Yeah, Fort Ethan Allen. John Duffy, what do you think Ethan Allen represents to people today?
Well, the strength of individualism is certainly exhibited there, and we're all drawn to it. Increasingly, we seem to be drawn to, you know, examples or instances of individualistic expression and effort. And it turns out that his performance has come down to us in a very specialized form. And we remember him in a very specialized way. And we were drawn to that feature.
You as authors?
As authors.
And Nick historians.
And we at one point would have fully agreed with Professor Randall, though we certainly did like to read the book. It's a good book to read. It's a good story. Ethan Allen is a good story, and it's a story that was created by him in part in his lifetime, but by a group of admirers who finally came to pay attention and create the story that has helped Vermonters at various times.
The early histories of the state, the first one by Samuel Williams, Ethan Allen does not play that central role. Governor Chittenden does. Some of the other people around him in Ira Allen. In Ira Allen's own history of the state, the second history of the state, Ethan is very prominent, but he is not a state builder in that. In fact, when the state was declared independent by itself, he was under captivity to the British. And none of the histories really until Jared Sparks' biography in 1833 really had Ethan as the central individual.
Well, and this seems to be one of the focuses of your book and your interest in this, is that we created this idea of Ethan Allen in Vermont as this icon of Vermont individualism and heroics because of something we needed at the time. We needed a hero in the mid-1800s here in Vermont, and Ethan Allen became that hero. But why? What was going on that we needed to, I won't say fabricate a hero, but create one out of something that was not quite the history of his actual life?
Well, the times, the 19th century was not a happy Victorian paradise for Vermont. Enormous change. I mean, nationally, there were enormous changes, economic changes through at a great war in which Americans killed many Americans. And the changes in technology from transportation and the printing, the steam press alone. And eventually, by the end of the century, the presence of combustion engines working in agriculture. All of this seemed to put a mark on the land that was disturbing to some people. They could look, and it turned out that prominent people were conscious of it, too.
At the end of the century, John, the population of the state was a little over 350,000. The population growth really pretty well stopped about 1810. There was a little spurt.
Well, yeah, you write that for a time, Vermont was seeing an incredible rate of growth, far surpassing the national average, and then sort of hitting the national
suddenly,
average.
Suddenly, about the time of the embargo and the War of 1812, things happen.
And suddenly we have almost no population growth, like 4% or something.
It sort of holds steady, and mostly people coming from Quebec and then from Ireland at first. But the leaders looked around them, and they were uncomfortable with this. Economically, they weren't developing the way they did. Population wasn't growing. 1816, every month of the year had a frost, and crops were in trouble. The social answers to this kicked up more dust and revivals and perfectionism. There were political answers in the Annie Mason movement. The first Vermonter ever to serve as a Vermont-born person to serve as a governor was Silas Jennison. He was an Annie Mason. They looked around as the sheep had come in, and the hillsides were being denuded.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we know that now that was fairly lucrative, but the traditional farmers looked at that and thought there was something wrong with this. It doesn't look like Vermont the way it should look, and they sought for answers.
So why Ethan Allen? I mean, you mentioned Ira Allen, his brother, and his brother was also famous at the time and wrote a lot as Ethan did, but in some ways perhaps Ira could have been a better
Ira
standard.
Died a pauper and the victim of a lot of lawsuits that he escaped to Philadelphia.
Yes. Ira's actual accomplishments in the years up to about the turn of the opening of the 19th century, his accomplishments, as far as Vermont was concerned, were significant. He was surveyor. He was the state surveyor.
A state treasurer.
State treasurer. Now, we have to get our minds into the past on this and realize what and understand that this is a very primitive frontier situation they're living in with amenities that would never conceive. We don't experience that life anymore the way a settler would have in the late 18th century. He's active. He's aggressive. He's a smart young man.
This is Ira you're talking about?
This is Ira. He's a smart young man. He sees the opportunities to the north and manages to bring his brothers together into a business that is successful in the sense of little investment and good return.
But not much cash flow.
All right, so we've X'd out Ira Allen. Yeah. Why Ethan?
He did capture Fort Ticonderoga in May 10.
He wrote a good book.
He wrote a narrative of his captivity, which was, I think, after Common Sense, the second bestseller in that period. He had fame. He was known.
So he was picked up in the 19th century?
Well, yes. We've read letters written in the 1830s and 40s essentially saying Vermont's in trouble and we've lost the moxie of those people in the Green Mountain Boys and the Green Mountain Regiment who made Vermont. And we need to return to those previous values. And they sought them out, and then they sought, Henry Stevens, the founder of the Vermont Historical Society, literally wrote to Gerard Sparks, who wrote the biography of Ethan Allen, the first one. And Sparks was the first person to hold a chair in history in the United States at Harvard. He was a very attractive man. He was very productive. And he went on to spend 10 years as president of Harvard University. When he came out and just took Henry Stevens's line on Ethan Allen and blew him into this revolutionary hero, and then very quickly followed by Daniel Pierce Thompson's
Green Mountain Boys, a book every Vermonter who was born, went to school, elementary school, before probably 1950, knew. They had it read to them in school. Before it, some teachers could be hired in some school districts. They had to show familiarity to the superintendent of the district with Thompson's book and the story of the Green Mountain Boys and Ethan Allen. It was a very good book to use as a disciplinary tool. At the end of the day, in a stuffed, hot, one-room schoolhouse, when the big boys wanted to get out and the little boys and girls were falling asleep, the teacher would pull out the book and read the next chapter. And everyone knew. I'm sure that Nick, as I had met people of an older generation than ours, most of them gone by now, who said that one of their fondest memories was Miss Smith reading that chapter before we had to walk home from school.
We're talking today about Ethan Allen. That's a wonderful way to think about how people came to know and love Ethan Allen because of this familiarity with him from an early age, this sort of indoctrination almost. And listeners, if you have questions about the Ethan Allen that you've grown up with and how he may be different than the Ethan Allen who actually lived, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. We're demythologizing Ethan Allen today. So if you have questions about why you think Vermont attached to him as a hero, again, our number is 1-800-639-2211, 1-800-639-2211, or you can post your thoughts on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. One of the things I loved about your book and how you describe him is that in some ways, Ethan Allen is almost thought of as the Daniel Boone of our area and sort of cut from this rugged cloth and hard scrabble existence. But you write, well, actually, he was kind of a middle class kid, came from a middle class family. This was not some hard scrabble life that he found his way into Vermont and into land. It was interesting to hear that this was just sort of the way it worked for people of his stature. How can you explain that?
He, as you're suggesting, he was a son of a family in which the father was a leader, a community leader, as was the father's brothers. When they moved across Connecticut and settled a couple of different times, the father, Ethan's father, and one or two brothers followed right along, established a town. Were selected by the townspeople for various positions of responsibility within the town. It was a good model at the time for a child to see and to learn from about how to behave like dad, like father.
And he was literate.
And father was literate. Mother was literate.
And Ethan was literate. And his father thought he should go to Yale and send him off to study under Reverend Lee to prepare for Yale. And after not very many months at that study, his father died suddenly, and Ethan, the eldest of the clan, came back to run the farm. And very clearly, he didn't love agriculture.
So Ethan Allen is often seen as one of the founders of Vermont and this sort of loyal patriot to the Vermont cause. But as you write in the book, there's some questions about that, about whether and how he was playing both sides when it came to the New Hampshire grants and the Yorkers, the New York grants, and what he was actually trying to gain from Vermont. Nick Miller, can you talk a little bit about the questions surrounding his motivations here?
Most of these, Jane, turn on what are known as the Haldeman negotiations. During 1780 and then 81, the British approached Ethan Allen, who was in Castleton, and suggested that Vermont should come back into the empire. And this would recognize Vermont land titles and give them sort of a status of a province of the British Empire. He rejected them on the outside, but allowed negotiations to go forward. And they were led by Ira and one of the Fay sons, and there were some others involved. It was really known by the Vermont Council, Governor Chittenden and others understood that these were going on. They really didn't let Ethan near these negotiations. And Ethan was known to be bibulous and known to be outspoken. And did you really want Ethan carrying on secret negotiations to return Vermont to the British Empire? One of the things, if you look at the histories of Vermont, the attitude toward Ethan will pretty well turn on the interpretation of whether those negotiations were real or whether they were a ruse to keep the British at bay on their northern frontiers and also to try to push Congress toward recognition of Vermont. That's the standard treatment. There are others who take a point of view that there was much more to these negotiations. And fairly clearly, Ira tried to hide them because when Samuel Williams wrote his history of Vermont, he asked Ira Allen about this, and Ira decided to let him see those papers. And then Ira met with Williams, and Williams writes to him not long after that that you needn't worry, there will be nothing in here that you wouldn't about which you wouldn't approve.
So the question really is whether or not Ethan and Ira Allen, but whether this family was trying to get the best deal for themselves, no matter who they had to align with, or whether they were really in it for the best and the sort of the best deal for Vermont.
Well, those are not necessarily mutually exclusive. I mean, they were certainly wanting to make sure that the New Hampshire titles stood. And that would have been a very good thing for a lot of people in Vermont. And that was one of the parts of the negotiation that resulted in Vermont statehood, was making sure that New York would give up any of the claims it had. I don't think John and I see it that quite that simply or black and white. What we're trying to get at is the behavior wasn't always as what's represented in the traditional views of Ethan. And, you know, John can talk a little bit. The traditional view of Ethan is a statue in the Hall of Statuary, or it's a statue on the porch of the state capitol, or it's on top of a 42-foot-high column in Greenmount Cemetery. And in those, he's always in a Continental uniform, but he never had a commission. And nobody knows what he looked like.
Yeah, John,
that's the interesting thing, that images in the mid-19th century start to appear of him. The first images of him are verbal images. They're verbal descriptions in Green Mountain Boys, for example. And
golden locks.
Golden locks, yes. Herman Melville, the American novelist, is drawn to Allen at one point, and in a short novel, he appears. Ethan Allen appears, a prisoner. And he describes him as this wonderful combination of great ferocity, energy, and spirit, the American spirit, the Western spirit, which is the true American spirit. And at the end of that section of the novel, this final scene, Ethan chained to a post in the middle of the castle in England, where he's a prisoner of war, is visited to be observed and entertain a group of ladies. And young ladies, of course. And one of them is so drawn to him and finds him so persuading and beguiling that she asks for a lock of his golden hair, and he lets her cut it and take it.
Revolutionary War Fabio.
Yes. From thenceforward, he's always going to have – as you go to the Green Mountain Cemetery, you can't see the color of the statue, but it's lockish. You know, even that the statue over in the State House porch that is older than the one in the Green Mountain Cemetery. When the statue was being prepared for the Green Mountain Cemetery, the chairman of the committee, George Perkins Marcy, says he doesn't want to see the new statue of the Green Mountain have a head on it like the one over in the State House. He said, the mug, I would have it burned in a kiln rather than put that head on it. And so he's been beautified too.
Yes, beautiful Ethan Allen. We're talking about him in all his guises today. And listeners, if you have questions, please do give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. What do you want to know about what is actually known about the truth of the life of Ethan Allen? You can post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. We'll get to your calls and emails in just a moment. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Nick Muller and John Duffy are the authors of Inventing Ethan Allen. They're with us today explaining how the myth of Ethan Allen doesn't necessarily conform with the truth of the man's life. If you have questions about what Ethan Allen was really up to, give us a call at 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post your questions on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net. Brandon is calling in now from Burlington. Hi, Brandon. Go right ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to separate a little family fact from family fiction. I'm a direct descendant of Seth Warner, and it was always told to me growing up that he deserved more credit than he was given, and that Ethan Allen was a drunk and a layabout. So, was mostly joking, but I was just wondering if that...
Brandon, I would agree with the first part of your proposition. Seth Warner has not gotten the due that he deserved. I wouldn't necessarily label Ethan as a drunk and a layabout, but he did like his flowing pool.
Brandon, the evidence of the neglect that Seth Warner, has experienced over the years is seen, I think, most strikingly in the statue of him in front of the Bennington Monument. It is a duplicate of the statue of Ethan Allen that stands in the Hall of Statuaries in Washington, D.C., in the Capitol. The third version of that is the statue over in Manchester called simply the Green Mountain Boys. It's identical. The three of them are identical. They were carved as much as 50 years apart. The one of Seth Warner being the latest. Someone had to have said when they walked through the Hall of a Vermonter had to have said at some point walking through the Hall of Statuary in Washington, saying, "Well, wait a minute. That's not Ethan Allen. That's Seth Warner." I hope they did anyway.
So maybe Seth Warner is the next book topic for the two of you.
No. Yeah, we're working on a book called Inventing Vermont.
Oh, no kidding.
Which is the 14 years of its independence.
Well, talk a little bit about Ethan Allen's role, because he in the founding of Vermont, because he often is seen as one of the founders. Right. But Nick, as you mentioned earlier, when Vermont was founded, he was in prison in Montreal, wasn't he? So Ethan Allen wasn't really involved in that.
In 1777, when Vermont was organized themselves as a state, he was a prisoner in New York, in New York City. And
The British moved him from Montreal to England to Ireland to New York.
That's one way to see the world.
He was paroled for a while on Long Island until he violated parole and got sent back to the city.
Yeah. So he was not. But in this, the wonderful story that he tells and his narrative about his exchange and gaining freedom, he tells George Washington, when he has an interview with George Washington, he tells him that he's going back to help little Vermont. And I believe that. I believe he said that. And I believe he did make efforts, serious efforts, to help Vermont. And he, but not in the in electoral politics, or certainly in functions of government, but not in not as a candidate or an elected officer. In fact, when he was elected from his town to the legislature, to the House of Representatives, he rejected it, refused to serve. However, he was a constant presence at meetings of the council and governor and council. And an advisor to them. And then finally, because of the prominence that he had achieved with Ticonderoga and writing that narrative, which was printed around the country at the time, reprinted, they appointed him leader of the Vermont militia, first colonel and then promoted him to general. He had many friends in the legislature who were willing to do that. He did not always have friends in the legislature. There were people with very different views of Ethan Allen. So he's a figure of some political prominence and fame and celebrity and all of that, but one who's managed to walk along a very narrow, dangerous path. You know, they sent him to Washington, they sent him to Philadelphia, to the Congress, at least three times as an envoy. And he was not very successful in any of them. Only the first time, before there was a Vermont, when...
Yeah, following Ticonderoga.
When he went to Congress and asked them to commission a regiment. And
Jane, there were a series of, they called them conventions, meetings, that began in December of 1775. Ethan was already captured then. And those series of meetings that brought about the Declaration of Independence in January of 1777 and the adoption of a constitution in July of that year demonstrate that Vermont was not in a state of nature. They, in fact, had meetings. Towns had organization. Towns were recording deeds. Towns were recording sales of land. Towns were taking care of marriages and all the kinds of things that would have been a part of late 18th century social and economic fabric. And Ethan was, it's true, he led the Green Mountain Boys and kept Vermont, New York's authority at bay. But he really was not in the mix when the Vermont independence was developed, declared, and for the better part of a year maintained.
Let's go to Laird, who's on the line with us from East Poultney. Hi, Laird.
Hi, thanks so much. And gentlemen, I look forward to reading your book. I teach a course called The Idea of Vermont down here at Green Mountain College. And one of the books that we read is Roland Robinson's Hero of Ticonderoga, featuring Ethan Allen. As I was preparing to teach that, I wanted as much historical context as possible. And the book that I found particularly influential was Revolutionary Outlaws, Ethan Allen and the Struggle for Independence on the Early American Frontier.
Michael Bilesiles.
Exactly. And, of course, he has fallen into disrepute since that book was published for the work that he researched in another book. And I'm wondering, how skeptical do I need to be of the portrayal of the Allen brothers and of the work of the Green Mountain Boys as a paramilitary organization?
Yeah, I'll jump in, and then John will not only assist me but improve me. I wrote an article, I don't know, it was really the start of this book, was an article that got me into looking at Ethan Allen's death. And I can find nowhere the famous lines that he gave to the attorneys Duane and Kemp in New York after the ejectment trials in 1770, that they had to come to Vermont and see that the gods of the hills are not the gods of the valleys. First place they find that's in actually Ira Allen's 1798 history. But if you read Belisle's, he says that Ethan Allen said that, and he loved to say it. He said it all the time. My view of Belisle's book is there's a lot of really interesting research in it, particularly the stuff he does with the courts. But he really falls into the standard Ethan Allen.
Yes. It was very hard, I think, to draw yourself away, to withdraw from constructed, the invented Ethan Allen. Michael's book, Michael also worked with me on the Ethan Allen and His Kin, the two-volume collection of the Allen family's letters. And a solid scholar for all of the work that he did with us. The Revolutionary Outlaw is still a valuable and insightful book in many ways. We have some fun with Michael in our version. We think that Michael and one of the other 20th century biographers of Ethan, Charles Jellison, we think that their treatment of Ethan Allen's second wife much in the manner of those 19th century historians. In other words, they treat her as if she were a woman of their time writing, where for Jellison, she's a tease. She's a 60. The book was produced in the 1960s. She's a 60s girl. For Michael, she's a modern woman. She's independent. She's an intellectual,
and a bit coquettish.
yes. But I mean, they are women of the author's times that they've left us with, and of course, the Ethan Allen that we're talking about is a creature of, in some many ways, a creature of the mid-19th century, the early 20th century. And we found great pleasure in reading Michael's book, and it's a lively book.
So in your estimation, I mean, you've done a lot of research now into what you can find out about what actually happened during Ethan Allen's lifetime and why he's become this icon, why Vermonters picked him up, why they needed a hero. What are the big questions that still remain for you about the life and times of Ethan Allen?
I'll be very quick and let John fill in. We ask in one chapter called Silence and Exclusion, we ask three questions that we don't answer, but we probe and tease. Did Ethan Allen ever kill anyone? Did Ethan Allen own slaves? Did Ethan Allen write his Reason, the Only Oracle of Man, which Michael Belisle says he did, but we think otherwise?
Yes. There are fair questions to ask. I mean, when you think of the first one, the slavery question, did Ethan Allen ever own slaves? He was a Connecticut man. Better than half his life was spent in Connecticut in growing up in businesses, and the businesses required labor, hard physical labor. We know there is a record that in one of those enterprises, there was one of the investors with him provided slave labor for it. We know that when he died, he had at least three black people, African American people, working for him on his farm. Whether they were free or wage workers, we don't know yet. But I think
we do know his brother brought a slave.
We know his brother brought a slave to Vermont, and we know that his granddaughter, his daughter Lucy, brought two slaves to Vermont and lived with her in the lived with them in the 1830s. And so, the question should be fairly treated: did he have slaves? Did he write that book himself, really?
Well, given that the questions remain, just before we let you go, Nick Miller, do you think he's still worthy of all of the sort of admiration that Vermonters have for him today?
Yes. It's hard not to like the man. And it's important for people to have heroes.
Nick Muller is a past dean and professor of history at UVM. John Duffy is emeritus professor of English and the humanities at Johnson State. Together, they wrote the book Inventing Ethan Allen. Thank you both so much for telling us a little bit more about what we do know about Ethan
Allen.
Nice
to be here with you, Jane.
Thank you very much for having us, Jane.
Now, coming up on the program, weighing the rights of patients who don't want to be forced to take psychiatric medication with the recommendations of doctors who say they need to. This is Vermont Edition. Welcome back to Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. Each year, a small number of people in Vermont are hospitalized in a psychiatric facility against their will. And when that happens, a court process ensues to determine whether or not those patients can be given medication, also against their will. Sometimes that process takes a couple of months. This session, lawmakers grappled with the issue of involuntary medication, trying to strike the right balance between helping people in a health crisis who might not be able to make lucid decisions, and also protecting their rights not to have medication they don't want forced on them. Anne Donahue is a representative from Northfield. She's thought about these issues a lot, both in her committee assignments and as a mental health advocate. And she's with us now to explain the compromise the legislature arrived at. Representative Donahue, nice to talk with you.
Hello. Thank you for having me on.
Can you explain what this bill does that passed?
Sure. I think it's important to recognize, and I wouldn't even call it a compromise necessarily, that you know, you can look at the Institute of Medicine, you can look at all of healthcare and recognize that best practice says that you want to work with someone and come up with a collaborative treatment. So something that's contrary to what a person wants is simply not going to work as well. The time investment to create a therapeutic relationship is vital, and we know that a forced treatment is even, in fact, highly traumatic and negative. So what we really tried to focus on was, are there exceptions where taking more time before having a judge create a substitute decision about what the patient would have wanted if they were competent, are there exceptions where taking that time is not going to be productive or the costs of it outweigh the benefits? And so that's where we ended up, is carving out a couple of specific types of situations where the standard length of time where one would be trying to avoid any kind of coercive treatment ends up not being safe or not being the best alternative, and needing to move more quickly than the usual process would take to have a judge make that decision about whether or not to move forward.
And what are the exemptions that you carved out, or the times and types of situations?
Well, there are really three basic ones. One is if a person has been hospitalized for 30 days already without having had any hearing, and they're worsening. Their illness is getting worse. So waiting longer and continuing to try to build a therapeutic relationship is to the detriment of the patient, and the doctor also has to show is not likely anymore to produce that hoped-for benefit of collaboration and agreement on a treatment plan. The second group, sort of similar, but this would be folks who have gone through the process previously within the last couple of years and ended up having an involuntary treatment order, medication order, and therefore creating some baseline of suggesting we're less likely to think we can establish that therapeutic relationship, and we're going to end up needing to move forward to a court decision. The third category, which is a small but important one, is if despite being in the hospital, a person remains at very, very high risk either to themselves or others, and therefore, again, the benefits of waiting outweigh the costs.
When there's a situation where a patient has had an order of involuntary medication in the past, does it have to be shown that that actually improved the situation for that patient?
No, not directly. What's more important is whether or not the overall history of what did happen contributes to a decision that right now, based on that, we can see that waiting for a judge to make a decision isn't going to create that therapeutic relationship or regaining capacity. It's important to remember that the decision about whether the person should receive medication against their will is still being made by the judge at a hearing. So the issue here is only, do we move more quickly to that decision, which might be a decision to involuntarily use medication? Do we move more quickly, or do we give that extra time to invest in trying to work out a treatment plan? So it has more to do with whether we're likely to get there and what the downsides of waiting are than whether the medication itself is the right decision or the best decision.
Does this bill also shift the decision-making process from the criminal division to family court? It looks in the language in the bill like there's some question or changes that move it to family court.
That was actually only a technical change. That
okay.
was a sort of error back when the whole court system was reorganized a few years ago. And that decision has always been in family court. There was a very another very important change that we included, however, and that was just in terms of being involuntarily hospitalized. Our existing law didn't create any judicial oversight of the system or for people in particular until, 30 or 40 or more days when they actually came up for a hearing before a judge on being held involuntarily. So a person would be held without any kind of judicial oversight. And we have now created a probable cause review process where a judge sees the paperwork that a hospital is filing, and from within 10 days from when a person first came into an emergency room, for example, a judge has to review that and make sure that it meets the legal standard for saying, yes, this person needs to be held for a commitment hearing.
Representative Donahue, are you satisfied with this bill? Do you think it's going to go in the right direction? Do you think it's going to go in the right direction?
I believe it does in terms of how it's structured. One never knows how practice matches up with structure. So the implementation will really be what tells us whether the balance is right in terms of protection of patients and meeting their needs and meeting what they would have wanted for themselves if they were able to make that decision, which is, of course, the gold standard for any kind of substituted decision.
There were some questions from patient advocates at the beginning of the session worried about any kind of legislation that was passed that this bill or any bill would make involuntary or forced drugging, as patients often call it, easier. Do you think their concerns have been addressed?
No, I think they continue to have those concerns, and I think that goes to the question of implementation. It certainly creates the potential that there would be an increase because for the categories of folks where the process can start earlier or move more rapidly. I don't think it necessarily creates that if it's used appropriately and cautiously, but there's certainly that risk, and we will have to watch it closely.
Do you think this is something the legislature would be likely to tackle again, or is this bill sort of what we've got for the foreseeable future?
I think it is what we've got. I would very much hope that if it turned out that it did not resolve problems or it created new problems, like expanding the number of people, which we would not want to be seeing, I would hope that we would address it and creating whatever adjustments are necessary.
Ann Donahue is a representative from Northfield. She sits on the House Human Services Committee and the Mental Health Oversight Committee, and she's been telling us about legislation passed this session that deals with the issue of involuntary medication for psychiatric patients. Representative Donahue, thanks very much for speaking with us.
Well, thank you for paying attention. It's an important topic.
And we'll continue to follow to see how it is implemented. But that will do it for today's show. Now, when you wash the dishes or you flush the toilet, you probably don't think too much about where that water is going next. Wastewater treatment plants are a critical piece of infrastructure that we usually don't notice unless something goes wrong. Tomorrow on Vermont Edition, we're going to look at water treatment plants and their role in clean water and public health. Vermont Edition is produced by Patty Daniels, Rick Singeri, and Sage Van Wing, with production assistance from Tim Johnson. Mary Williams directed the show. Our executive producer is John Van Hoosen. And our theme music was composed by Grace Potter and the Nocturnals. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.